Podcast.
I am one of the few people who think the Patriots are actually going to be really good this year.
Let's go!
Oh, God.
It's me. It's Kevin Wiles.
What a shocker. Surprise.
All right, welcome to the latest edition of the R. Bill Simmons podcast. And for this episode, Spotify, it's in the news. We talked about it last pod. We're going to get way more into it this pod. We both had the new Joe Rogan contract, significantly different than his previous one. So it's got a lot of interesting, we got a lot of interesting things to talk about with that contract. But then also, Spotify just had earnings. And Wall Street reacted positively to that. There is a lot of interesting insights by the Spotify management that Wall Street reacted to positively. And so to break down all of this, we have somebody that talks about Spotify a lot, is on a podcast. We got Brett, the host of the Chit Chat Stocks podcast. He's also a writer at Motley Fool. What's going on, man? Thanks for being here.
Yeah, glad to be here. Glad we could finally do this. I know we've been following each other on the old Twitter machine for a while now. And yeah, I've been following Spotify. I guess the one other entity that controls the destiny of the Bill Simmons podcast potentially. So hopefully for your listeners, we can get some insights into their strategy, what they're doing with all this podcast content stuff, which people seem to be very confused about, as well as, you know, why the stock's up. I think last I checked 200% since the beginning of 2023. So quite the run here.
Bill might be thinking, man, I should have taken some Spotify stock instead of the cash payment because this thing has been on an absolute tear lately. But yeah, I thought you would be the perfect guest to come on for this. And we've been talking Spotify back and forth on Twitter or X. And we figured let's do a pod about it because this is a subject I think a ton of listeners of this podcast would very much be interested in. So I think maybe a place to start, we can hit on their earnings, maybe just a couple of main takeaways and why Wall Street reacted positively. And then from there, I think we can go more in depth into the business. But just briefly, wrapping up the earnings, why do you think there was such a positive reaction to it?
Yeah, so we're going to hit, for any of the listeners, a lot of the podcast stuff later with advertising segment, all that stuff. And I would say that the stock has done so well and Wall Street investors are reacting so well despite the advertising business struggling so much. And it really comes down to the music business being, I mean, I was pretty bullish on the quality of the music business a couple of years ago, but it's even better than I think the most bullish investors thought. I mean, we got their total users passing 600 million, that's beating their own guidance, growing 23% year over year. Now, a lot of that's in their rest of world markets. They're doing quite well in, like, say, India and Indonesia, but their premium subscribers, which are the ones that pay for the ads free music service, are growing still 15% year over year. And that came with the price increases this summer. And I believe, I don't know exactly how many markets it was, but most importantly, it was North America, so their biggest market from a revenue perspective, the United States. They grew the monthly price from, I think, $10 to $11, and that had no impact, you know, on churn, on people going to Apple Music or going to YouTube Music or wherever, and they're still growing. So they're posting foreign exchange neutral growth, I should say, actually, where I don't have that in the notes here, but either way, they're growing about 20%. In that business with expanding margins. And I think when that, a lot of people were pretty skeptical about that. And I think that's really why they're growing so much, why the stock's doing so well. And then also it's because their margins are actually getting a little bit better than people expected. They keep and have been saying in kind of their investor presentations, when they do a big investor day, they say, hey, we want to get to 10% profit margins over time. Cause right now they have been running in the red for a while, and I don't think people believe them, but now they're actually showing quite a bit of, as some people might say, a little bit of leg, and they're showing people that they can actually generate a profit. And despite having the 17% layoff last quarter, which will save them money, you know, in 2024, but they had to take the severance hit in Q4, their operating margin was only -2% and would have been positive like 1 or 2% in Q4 if they didn't have these severance charges, which are going to go away in Q1, Q2, Q3. So they should see margins really start to expand in 2024. And, you know, the market's forward looking, and I think they see that.
Okay, that's a helpful overview. So the bullish case, which means positive for the non-stock inclined listeners here, the bullish case is that they can keep on expanding these margins. Now, as you hit on, the bearish case, meaning people are negative, would be they have low margins, and even if they do improve them, this is more of a low margin business. So for the music business, they're paying a pretty decent amount of cost to the labels, correct? But the idea here would be they can still grow margins even regardless of how much they're paying the labels for the rights to the music.
Yeah, that's correct. Where I think people get misguided is, yes, they have to pay out to the music labels, but they're a giant partner with these labels. Now, if anyone follows the industry, they may have seen, because it became quite big news, where Universal just took their music off of TikTok. They would never do that with Spotify because they are such a big revenue source for the company. So they say their relationship with the labels has never been better. And yes, they're paying, I think, 65 to 70% of their revenue out to them. But after that, the incremental margins you're going to get from a new subscriber are going to be quite high. And I think what people are excited about is that despite the multiple layoffs they've done over the last few years, the premium music business hasn't skipped a beat. They raise prices, churn's low, they're growing in all their markets. So gross margins aren't going to expand to the level of, you know, some of the high quality software businesses out there, or some of the high quality consumer businesses out there like Google or Facebook or something like that. But despite that, you know, you can't expect that. I think you should just, they expect margins to be at about 30 to 35% on a gross basis, which just means after what they pay out to the music labels and their payment, you know, processing and all that good stuff with their cloud computing costs. And right now it's at about 26 to 27%. So they think it can expand a little bit, but really the key is that they can grow much more efficiently than people thought, where they're, I think I have the notes here from the document, they're full-time employees. At the end of 2022, we're over 10,000. It was about 10,100. And at the end of this year, it was actually down to 9,200. Wow. So the fact that they were able to grow and really accelerate revenue growth, they talked about this on the conference call, where they think that they just run better, more efficiently. They had a lot of bloat. I think the 2020, 2021 bubble kind of got to them like a lot of other companies didn't. They're moving through that. And a lot of these costs that has been leading them to have, like, you know, negative 5% operating margins, which we'll talk about, it comes with the podcasting, but it also comes with a lot of R&D projects that they do. I read a book, The History of Spotify. If anyone's really interested in this company, it's called The Spotify Play. I think you can find it in an English version, but it's written by a Swedish guy, I believe. And they have a lot of crazy R&D projects going. They at once had something with like Nike. They were trying to do something with running. They were trying to do a hardware project at one point. And they used to have all these things, you know, as everyone does. They have an AI division now. But I think they realized that Wall Street's not going to believe them unless they actually show them that the underlying unit economics of the business are great. And most of the employees are not associated with the premium music business, the subscription business. It's, I mean, if you kind of think about it, it's one that kind of runs itself once you set things up, and you don't need more than maybe 1,000, 1,500 employees to run one of these things. And a lot of the employees they have there are for these R&D, sales, whatever, the advertising stuff. But the core music streaming business is, I think, much more profitable. And now everyone kind of agrees it's actually might be a pretty good business with, now this one's more of a debate, but with, I would argue, significant pricing power.
Mm. So this reminds me of a couple things. And in general, that's really helpful because basically, I guess the thought is that there's some fat to cut. And I think we're seeing this all over because if you look Amazon, new headlines every day that Amazon is cutting the Alexa division or they're firing some employees in Prime or just every single day we get a headline like that. You've got Meta. You talk about Spotify going down from 10,000 to 9,200. Meta, 25% year-over-year decline in employees, and they have absolutely not lost any productivity. And in fact, Zuck says they're gaining productivity because they're leaner teams. What you talked about with Spotify and their R&D spend, that reminds me of the Google Other Bets, right? Where basically Google has this incredible cash flowing, maybe the best business in the history of businesses, Google search business, although maybe that will be disrupted by AI, we'll see. But at least until recently, it was this best business. And it afforded them the opportunity to do all these other bets, which really haven't paid off. I remember like some balloons that were trying to deliver internet and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
So it seems like from what you're saying, the strength of the music business has actually been hidden by Spotify spending in other areas, and now they are taking a little bit less spending in those other areas, letting the music business shine. And now investors are kind of happy with that. And I wanted to follow up on that because I'm seeing these results too. Over 600 million users worldwide, over 200 million premium. So is this like penetrating new markets? Is this winning the market share versus Apple Music and YouTube Music? Like, how are they adding so many subs at such a fast pace? Still.
Yes, yeah, so I can hit on that one. They have a great chart that anyone can find if they go on their investor relations page and just look up the quarterly. I think they call it a slide deck, but it's essentially a quarterly letter. And they have four different markets. So they have Europe, which is their most mature since they invented the music streaming business in the Nordics, and they went to Western Europe and then they came to the United States. And then you have North America. Then you have Latin America, and then you have rest of the world. And rest of the world is basically everywhere except for Western, Central Europe and the Nordics, North America and Latin America. So think Africa, basically all of Asia, excluding China, Australia, those good places. If we look at Q4 2019, so they divide their MAUs by those separate markets, we have 35% Europe. Sorry, there's going to be a lot of numbers here, but 35% Europe, 27% North America, 22% Latin America, and then 16% rest of world. We go to Q4 2023, which is the one they just reported. They have doubled their percentage in rest of the world to 32%. And remember, that's when they've gone from probably like 300 MAUs, monthly active users, to over 600 million. So now 32% are from rest of world, 22% still the same from Latin America, and then 19% North America, 28% Europe. So it's really this rest of world push, which is India, Indonesia. It's really a lot of kind of India and Southeast Asia that they're doing quite well. And those aren't going to be, from a monetization perspective, they're not going to be that valuable today, but over the next 5 to 10 years, they can probably add a good amount to this business, especially if you can hit, I mean, India's got 1.5 billion people. There's probably still 100 million getting added to, as internet users each year. It might not be that. So just saying as an example, there's still a huge tailwind for them there. And if they even are one of, three or four players in the Indian market, they could have 300 million users just in that country. So there's just a long runway to grow these MAUs. But from a revenue perspective, it's going to be, can they go from a $10 a month in the United States to $15 a month in 2028, 2029, 2030, if they really wanted to, without impacting churn? That's going to be more important in the next few years from a, top line growth perspective.
So this is reminding me of Netflix a little bit in that they just gain this insane kind of scale. And so it makes me wonder why are they the ones that are having so much success even internationally too? Like, are Apple and YouTube Music or whatnot, are they not pursuing the opportunity, or is it just that Spotify can execute the best and they're going in maybe first too. Maybe they have a first mover advantage.
Yeah, that's a good question. Where the bear case on from a, like a business perspective or a user growth perspective since 2015 has been, well, Apple's in it, YouTube's in it, all of big tech's in it, even Amazon. And despite that, they've continued to grow. And I think it's a few things. One, it's the focus, where this is their number one priority. And across those other companies, they could really care less how high quality the service is. And two, I think it's their discovery tools, where I mean that from a user perspective. So you have Discover Weekly, you have that new AI DJ that has really taken off. You have this thing that they just came out with, I believe it's called the Daylist, that people are really going after. They just love the service. They have, it's kind of hard to say, like, okay, well, they have this big competitive advantage. But I kind of, when talking with investors, flip it around and say, all right, they've been competing with the most capitalized businesses in the world. You have YouTube, which is owned by Alphabet/Google. You have Apple. And those two companies control the platform that Spotify is on and are very anti-competitive to Spotify. Apple doesn't allow, you know, subscriptions in the app. There's been all the stuff that Spotify and Match Group, the dating app company, and some of the video game companies are suing them over their app store practices. And despite all this, Spotify has gained market share. And I think you kind of got to look at that and say, look, they just executed better, similar to a Netflix. And maybe combine it as a similar to a Netflix and a Roku, where the competition with Roku is, you know, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, and Chromecast. And who else is there? Samsung. And despite that, they've, you know, they're the leading smart TV player in the United States, despite the competitive disadvantage, you would say, versus the big tech players.
Gotcha. And for context for the listeners too, looking at their financials, so the premium we're talking about here, which is paying for the subscription, we got 3.2 billion euros. Is that right?
That's right.
This past in 4Q23, this past quarter, and then 501 million ad supported for a total of 3.7 million billion euro financials. So this premium business, very important, and that grew at 15% year over year, whereas the ad-supported MAUs, monthly active users, grew 28% year over year. So I look at that and go, yeah, sure, the MAUs are growing 28% year over year, which is faster, but 15% premium year over year is pretty robust growth still. At this level of 236 million premium subscribers. And I would imagine that there absolutely can be an upsell eventually where some of those ad supported users go to the premium tier.
Yeah, that's been their funnel. And over the longest time, they've said that there's a certain percentage in each geography that converts over time. So say if you have this cohort that joins as an ad supported user, in the first quarter, X percent will join as premium subscribers over the next 18 to 24 months. And it's been pretty consistent, but on the whole, and I think this is because they're in the a lot of poorer countries now, it's been a higher percentage of ad-supported users. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, but I think, you know, in every single one of their markets, they are still growing. And I think that's important when you look at not only Europe, which is an important market for them, but using Europe, which is, say, 3 to 5 years ahead from a penetration perspective versus the United States, that the United States still has 3 to 5 years of growth before, you know, they get to any sort of sense of, you know, subscriber maturity in the music streaming business. And I think people underrate, especially people that are, you know, online, have maybe been Spotify subscribers since they joined United States, you know, 10 years ago, that there are still a lot of people out there that don't use these things. And there's a lot of, you know, greenfield left for Spotify to grow, even in North America.
That makes sense. And then, yeah, talking about the ARPU, the average revenue per user, and price hikes, from my perspective, I would look at it and go, if the price hikes aren't irrational, $1 or $2 a year on average, let's call it, for the typical user, you subscribe to Spotify and you get basically all of the music that has ever been created. So it's a pretty incredible value, I think. And the argument for Netflix and the bull case for them over the past decade, which has completely played out, is that when you were paying $7 for Netflix in 2012, it was this amazing deal, yes, because at least at that point you were getting all the TV that was created. Now it's a little bit different because they license less, but then they're doing their own shows. But the argument there was always they have a ton of pricing power. And we compare this to the cable TV bundle, which I talk a lot about on the show because it includes ESPN and Disney. But the thought was that linear TV bundle is 70, 80 bucks. Netflix is 7 to 10 bucks. It's got a ton of pricing power. So do you feel like it's pretty reasonable that, as long as they're not doing three, four, $5 price increases annually, that they have some decent runway in terms of ARPU over the next several years?
I think so, especially in the United States and Europe, which again, I'm mentioning those because those are the ones that are most important today from a revenue perspective. They started out in the United States, I believe it was equivalent in Europe, but let's just keep it, for the US listeners, we'll keep it in dollars. They started out at $10 a month over 10 years ago, and they just raised it by $1 to 11.
Wow.
And I don't know exactly what ceiling they have is, but if you go on an even inflation adjusted back, to then, I think they have room basically indefinitely to raise the price by a dollar every 2 to 3 years, if not more. Now, it's not as attractive because there are the variable costs that they pay out to the suppliers, which, I mean, is the labels and the artist. So it's not as attractive as Netflix, where Netflix had these huge operating leverage on their fixed content costs, where now they can push, I think they're into the 20s on operating margin, and they could easily push to 30%. Now there's going to be a ceiling there for Spotify, but it doesn't necessarily, in my mind, make it a bad business. It's just going to be not as high as margin of Netflix, but I think from a revenue perspective, there's just a lot of runway to grow, and it would honestly please a lot of stakeholders because one, I don't think users are going to complain because it's really cheap. Like you said, all the music in history, they just added audiobooks. You get 15 hours of audiobooks, I think either a month or a quarter. I can't remember the exact thing, but they're adding more services, audio services onto this premium subscription. But it's going to please the labels. Get them, they're making them more money if they raise prices, but it's also going to please the artists. And that was one of the key stakeholders that people were worrying about over the last few years is what is, I mean, how common was it? Was it every like day where an artist would complain about Spotify properly paying them? Which we don't need to go into a 20-minute discussion about how that was a bunch of nonsense. But if Spotify is raising prices, 70% is going to go through to the artists. That's going to make them more happy. That's going to make them invest in the platform. I think it just widens their competitive advantage versus all the other subscale players. I mean, if you look at them versus, say, a Pandora, I mean, they just wipe, there's no one left except the big tech competition.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think they have plenty of pricing power. It's actually potentially shocking that they haven't used it yet. I understand your point that yes, they use it to an extent. They would, if they use it, they have to pay, they potentially would have to pay more to the labels. But man, it is such a good deal. And for, for the millennials listening, I know I'm early 30s. We remember buying one CD for 15 bucks. I mean, I would go to the, I think you'd go to the local shop that had CDs and you look around, you get 10 songs, or you go on Apple and you were paying 99 cents for a song. So 10 bucks, 11 bucks, 15 bucks for monthly music. I mean, that is at least historically looking a massive deal for people in my age group, like early 30s and millennials in general. But I think it's a pretty good deal for the younger generations that live online too. I mean, it's just kind of doing, it's an expense that's part of doing business as someone that is living in that online community and would have music every month. So yeah, I agree. I think it's a good deal.
Yeah, and here's the thing that not everyone watches TV. Now, most people do, but every single person in the world, maybe not every single person, let's say 99% of the people in the world listen to music. Everyone eventually is, or let's say 99% of people are going to go on smartphones eventually. There is a, I think, much larger runway for just, you know, it's kind of a, everyone cringes when you use this term, but I'll say addressable market, you know, in the investing world, that term gets overused, but there is a giant addressable market and they could easily hit 1 billion users within, you know, this decade. And then I would also say from a business quality perspective, it's one of those services where if you're looking at your bank statement and it goes from $10 on the little thing list you have of your expenses and it goes to $11 the next month, you're not going to look at that because what you're already paying, let's say you're, you know, someone that watches sports, like maybe someone listening to this podcast, you're already paying YouTube TV, you're already paying maybe ESPN Plus, all these other things that combine together from your entertainment perspective. And that's just much more than music. And you're probably using your music streaming service multiple hours per day compared to, and I don't know, it's just, I think price per, you know, consumption or whatever and all the value there is just much higher. And you only need one of these things, which some people think is a negative because at the end of the day, a lot of the content is a commodity. But if Spotify can keep people from churning and you only need one of these things, you can have much higher pricing power than someone like Netflix, who was competing with separate content versus someone like HBO Max or whatever they're calling it now.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And those shows, man, get when The Last of Us comes back, right? You get Max for a month or two and then you drop it. And then, hey, Peacock had the NFL playoff game and maybe I'll watch some Office and Parks and Rec, get that for a couple months. And oh yeah, Disney Plus, maybe Deadpool 3 comes out or something and I'm watching it there. So yeah, there's easily the ability for you to switch on and off those. And those presumably would be much higher churn than Spotify. So I completely agree with that. I think that makes a lot of sense. But yeah, let's do this. I think we've hit extremely well on the music business. Let's now transition over to ad supported, which includes the podcasting business. So maybe if you can give a brief overview of that business with potentially an addition of why do you think Spotify pursued the podcasting business in addition to what they currently have with music?
Yeah. Okay. So maybe we can give some history on what and how they got to where they are today. And then we can kind of go through the financials and how they're trying to make money. So starting in this is a rough timeline. So anyone that has any exact stuff, I could hit, you know, any listeners, I could get stuff roughly wrong here, but I think it's directionally right. In 2018 or so, they realized that podcasts were really growing and they kind of realized that people were just uploading podcasts onto Spotify as like music, but it was actually a podcast. And they said, hey, like, this is basically what we do. And it's kind of the future of, you know, radio, or similar to how music streaming is going to disrupt the traditional music, you know, listening experience. But with talk radio, we're really behind on this, but it has a lot of potential and we don't have to deal with labels, which honestly, they kind of have to deal with some of the content providers now. So I don't think it's the exact, you know, magical business that they thought they were going into. So they said, hey, we're way behind here. Apple Podcasts is dominating. They're still kind of YouTube, but they aren't as big as they are today. But there's one player that's dominating here. Okay. We have to be very innovative in how we're going to attack this market, because we have to go from basically 0% listeners and we got to have a decent amount of market share for this to work for us. So they did a lot of stuff. First, one of the first acquisitions was The Ringer. That was one of their first content acquisitions, but they bought three different studios, The Ringer, Parcast, and Gimlet. The Ringer was honestly the one that was the most successful, even though neither of those three have been home runs. But under the hood, they bought two companies that were quite important, Megaphone and Anchor, which we talked about before. We both distribute our podcast on Anchor. They're the distribution platforms. Now, Megaphone is more professional. I believe The Ringer might have been using them before they acquire them. But say, for example, ESPN or Bloomberg, they use Megaphone for more professional distribution tools. And what the distribution thing does is it allows any podcast, this one, you know, you put in your title, you put in your notes, you upload your audio file or even video file now, and then it distributes it to all the players. So that could be Spotify, that could be Apple, that could be whoever. And Anchor has a gigantic amount of market share. And I believe if you combine the two from a listening perspective, Spotify now dominates the distribution market. And that's important because one, well, you can go from no podcast getting listed on Spotify to having all of them getting listed on Spotify because you just update Anchor and say, hey, you know, you're distributing to Apple Podcasts. Now you can distribute to Spotify. But then it comes time to, all right, well, the existing users are still listening to, biggest example, we're going to talk about that, is the Joe Rogan Experience. And they're listening to that on Apple and YouTube. And we'd much rather have them listening to Joe Rogan on Spotify. And he wasn't even on that at the time. So we kind of need to play catch up. And I think that's why they did these content deals with the big time existing shows, is they treated it as a customer acquisition tool where you have the Joe Rogan Experience exclusive on Spotify. He already has, what, like 10, 20 million listeners. All right, well, that's, you know, that's pretty meaningful for us, especially for a lot of them being in the United States and North America. And we can make money on them by convincing them to join our music streaming service. And they said it was not only helpful, and we'll get to maybe the advertising stuff next, but it's only helpful in that regard from a direct podcast, you know, listening perspective, but the combination helped reduce churn in their premium subscription business because they had people coming to the application more. And then you're kind of, you know, any listeners probably maybe thinking, okay, well, they spend all this money on these distribution tools. They spent all this money on The Ringer. What was that? $200 million plus these other ones. But how do they plan to make money? And the plan is, and I guess they've built it over the last few years, but there's still a lot of work to be done, is to build a YouTube-like advertising platform where you can kind of click and embed stuff, but I'll maybe leave it there, where there's a lot of follow-ups and areas we can go in, especially with, you know, what they're doing with The Ringer as kind of one of their, I'd say, trial and error tools, where they kind of use their shows to test new products and new advertising tools. But I think the key for them to get into podcasting was increase the amount of consumption hours on the platform. And luckily, when we recorded this, they just released their SEC filing with their annual report. And they had, we have an updated number now. So in 2023, there was 165 billion consumption hours on Spotify, growing 25% year over year. And that compares to 2015, so just 8 years ago, at 17.4 billion. Consumption hours. And I think a lot of that growth is due to podcasting. And now the question is, and I guess I'll maybe throw out one number here, with their advertising revenue only at, you know, 500 million last quarter, growing even slower than the larger premium business, is, okay, you've made all this, you know, people are listening to podcasts on Spotify, you're the leader, can we make money? And I don't know, maybe we can have a discussion on that and how they can do that.
That makes a lot of sense. And okay, that makes sense in terms of Spotify is this massive audio platform and all of a sudden wakes up one day and says, wait a minute, there's this new form of audio taking off like a rocket. We need to be in this. And to their credit, they gained a ton of market share where they are now the leading podcasting player. So clearly what they did worked to get a higher market share. Obviously, the question is, did they make money? So maybe the first angle I want to hit on is, so we talked Rogan, and you talked about the benefits that they were aiming for when they did that deal. Now we have this new deal comes out, and I think the main headline of that is they will distribute his podcast in all forms, including YouTube. They'll help him with the advertising, I believe. Those platforms like YouTube, and that it's more of a lower guarantee for him, but revenue sharing. And then I was reading a JP Morgan Wall Street piece, and they were highlighting hey, we like the cost control in the new podcasting deals, including Joe Rogan. They specifically called that deal out after they wrote about the earnings piece. So I'm curious what you think from the perspective of, so they've switched the deals. The easy answer would be, okay, like that last deal failed. It didn't do what they wanted to do. They have to change it now. They overpaid. But maybe maybe a different angle to take was, maybe that deal accomplished what they wanted to at the time, and now they're in a little bit of a different phase of the business. So where do you kind of fall on that?
Yeah, that last thing you said there took the words right out of my mouth. I agree with that. Now, I want to give context for the listeners. I'm putting on my rose-colored glasses here. I have been frustrated with their podcast and advertising segment, so I'm trying to maybe go a little bit of an optimistic spin here. But when you look at when they did the Rogan deal back in 2020, their user base and market share in podcasting was much, much lower. They had no video podcasting tools, and their advertising business, which we'll get to next, I guess, was much, much smaller, basically non-existent from their digital ad insertions. For anyone that might be confused, just think of it like a YouTube ad, but an audio version. So it kind of, pops in whenever the publisher decides. Now, their first goal in podcasting was to get people to listen on Spotify and to get users to grow. Now, what has it been, 3 years now with Rogan, maybe a little bit more? And I think if that was the goal, they accomplished it, because users, MAUs, consumption hours, their market share in podcasting has grown substantially, and they got 10 to 20 million people. We don't know the exact numbers. That's just a ballpark, to listen to Rogan on Spotify. And they're not really, I don't think they're worried anymore about user growth. And I don't think they're saying, okay, I keep using India as an example, but we're in India. Just because we have Rogan exclusive on Spotify, that's not going to convince anyone to sign up with us versus YouTube Music, Apple Music, or trying to remember it's like Jira. Starts with a J. It's one of the local competitors there. That's not going to move the needle anymore, but now we're really trying to grow the advertising business, which has been much slower than they, initially expected. It's been a pretty big disappointment, I would say, among investors and the company in general, where it's been pretty sluggish on growth. And if you can get, now YouTube's a little bit different, where it's not the RSS feed. I'm not sure exactly what they're going to do there, so table that. But with Apple Podcasts, which still has, say, pretty equivalent market share to Spotify, but is losing a little bit, their advertising tools can dynamically insert, or I wouldn't use that term, they can insert advertisements onto an Apple Podcast player now because they own the distribution platforms. So they can put Rogan on Apple Podcasts. Maybe there's 5 million people that listen on Apple, or maybe it's a million. And if you can get the equivalent CPM, you can get that, advertising there. I mean, Apple's not making any money on that, and Spotify is the one that can make money. And if you're not losing any listeners to Apple because of this, it doesn't seem like it's a losing scenario. And you can get a better ROI on the content deal. And their whole, I think, goal now for any of these content deals, the only reason they keep them around is to build the advertising network. And that's what I think the lens anyone reading about this has to look at it through.
So I think what you just said there, better ROI in the content deal, is exactly potentially the missing piece of what people don't understand about the Spotify podcasting strategy. Because I think that the bearish case, and I've kind of argued this on this podcast before, is that I don't love the idea of, let's say simplistically, okay, Bill Simmons, his contract is up next year. He signs a $10 million deal. I'm wondering, how does Spotify make money on that? Because they'd have to do, 11 million plus in advertising revenue to make that profitable. But the ROI and content, what I think you're saying, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what I think you're saying is basically that Spotify can sign these artists to deals, but because of their advertising, because of the network you talked about, they can actually get more dollars on these content deals than other platforms, and that's a big part of their long-term strategy. And you're both keeping the content on the Spotify platform, but also growing revenue on the other platforms if more people listen to them. So is that kind of a reasonable way to assess it?
Yeah, I think so. Let's see. I think, yes, they just have better reach. And second, the shows are much happier if they're on, you know, wherever people can get them. They have other goals besides making money for Spotify. So, you know, for example, we'll use Rogan again. He might want more people but to know about his comedy shows, or that comedy club he opened in Austin, or whatever, the UFC stuff. I don't know what his goals are, but they would like that. And it's in general, I mean, if you even look at the exclusives, Spotify was a much better deal than SiriusXM, who threw out some money, or iHeartRadio, or Amazon Music. I mean, because no one's, from a podcasting perspective, no one's listening on these places. But their goal, they need to get a big enough mass of advertisers into their advertising network. And to do so, I think they want some of their existing shows to have more advertising slots. So instead of Rogan maybe having 10 to 15 million listeners, it bumps up to 20, 25 now that it's available everywhere. And that can convince more of these advertisers to switch from, you know, radio, talk radio, which still does quite a few, you know, listen to talk radio. There's still a lot of ads on there. There's a lot of money spent on these things. They need to convince them. That's their number one goal now with podcasting, is they have the consumption. They need to convince people to join their advertising network. And that's how they're going to get the ROI, because they're spending a lot of money. And I would say, to wrap this up, is they envy YouTube. Because I think ideally they don't deal with any of these people, but they're not a monopoly like YouTube. So they're not in as ideal of a spot, if that makes sense.
Yeah, this is coming into focus exactly what their strategy is. I'm pumped even for myself doing this podcast, because I'm learning a lot from you. This is great. I hope the listeners are too. Okay, so we have this. Now let's dive into the Bill Simmons of it all here. So Bill Simmons obviously gets bought by Spotify. They initially called it the next ESPN. I'm not sure it necessarily hit that, but what's been interesting is that there's a lot of press on Spotify, right? Because it's a very popular company. Everybody knows it because a lot of people use it. And what we're seeing in Wall Street Journal, The Verge, The Ringer, now this is on a relative basis, but their show is doing very well. The press is saying that, as compared to some celebrity deals they signed where it was 200,000-300,000 an episode, Bill Simmons and The Ringer, they're producing a lot of content, a lot of quality content at low prices. So with that context for the listeners, where do you feel like Simmons and The Ringer fits into this podcasting strategy, and do you view it as a success so far?
I think The Ringer was a success for them. Now, Gimlin and Parcast, maybe not as much, but we'll focus on The Ringer here. I mean, it was a $200 million deal essentially for the Bill Simmons podcast, because you can think equivalently. You got basically The Ringer and, you know, all of that for a deal that Rogan's not, you know, as much bigger, but he did, what, $100 million a year? If you look at maybe an equivalent show size-wise to the Bill Simmons podcast, you had Call Her Daddy, which I think was $60 million in total. So it's not that bad from how they would have done it maybe a couple of years later with Simmons. But I think their goal at the start, so say 2019 to 2023, say the end of this year, they wanted to use content as The Ringer to convince people to listen to podcasts on Spotify. Now, they didn't use it as much for The Ringer as they did with other stuff and making exclusives, but they also used it as a testing ground for advertising tools. They use it as a testing ground for new formats like video, new clickable advertisements, lots of the stuff I think people have seen on Spotify, where you have the polls, you have the comments that they're doing on there now. But most important was to get, let's say, in aggregate each month, The Ringer does 50 million listens. I don't know exactly what the number is, but let's say you add it all up, it's 50 million. That was valuable to them because they could launch an advertising network and say, look, we have 50 million of existing advertising slots. People already advertise with them. I mean, what do they probably have, like a $20 million deal with FanDuel? If we're kind of looking equivalent for you know, some of the other players like Pat McAfee or something like that. And they can use that and say, look, who's an advertiser? Coca-Cola. Say, hey, look, they're, I don't know, you always joke around, but some of the advertisers that advertise on Bill Simmons, like the Hilton, yeah, or something the like McDonald's, that. It's all big brands, yeah. Now.
The McDonald's one is good when Bill says he was the first guy to put the ice in first before he puts the Sprite in.
Yeah, and I will say now they some of it might be AI coming forward where they've done that AI voice stuff. So I don't know exactly if he's actually saying that, but I think they just might be testing that for something, you know, in a couple of years now. But back, you know, 2019 and 2023, they used the Ringer content as a springboard to get supply and say, like, because you can't just go to, you know, one of our podcasts and say, look, hey, advertisers, sign up. We got this. These niche shows, they're like, why would we advertise there? And it's like, no, we have the most listened to sports podcast ever, you know, at the time. It's definitely whatever, like top three, top five and from listenership. And you can advertise here. We're going to, and the key is to, okay, like the listener might not know a difference between what an advertisement was in 2018 versus how it is today. But on the back end, they want to make it so you can just insert a time slot and then it has an automated uploaded ad that can go in there from one of these advertisers that Airbnb records the ad. And they're not necessarily going to the podcast anymore and advertising. They're saying, okay, you're going to spend $20, $30 million with the Spotify advertising network. Mm-hmm. And we're going to distribute your shows targeted to, you know, as best they can. They're not going to be as good as Meta or Alphabet, but we can target it much, much better. It's going to be dynamic insertions. We're going to be able to track it with much better analytics. And that was the key for the Ringer then. But today, I think they're much less valuable to Spotify. And I don't think they want to own content going forward because as a lot of people know, it's much better to be the YouTube, the Instagram, the whoever that doesn't own anything and just be the one in the middle of these advertising deals and not have to be a Netflix. It just makes things more complicated.
Interesting. So that's where I was going to go next. And so you basically hit on it, but I was going to ask, what is your prediction? Let's assume that I think Bill's his contract is up next year. Let's assume that the other Ringer personalities, same thing, that and maybe the website, you know, goes for 5 years. What is your prediction for post that initial agreement lapsing, what happens with Bill and maybe some of the other top podcasts at the Ringer?
Yeah, this is a tough one. And I would say for the listeners, I'm being speculative here, but I would predict that he sticks around because they made him head of sports content or whatever and sports monetization or some title, but they elevated him just above that. And he has a bigger responsibility at the company. And they can pay better than anyone else. YouTube doesn't do this. Where is he going to go? Apple, SiriusXM? I mean, those are... Apple Podcasts isn't dying, but they don't do anything with it. SiriusXM, when necessarily say is dying, but is much smaller. There's just nowhere else to go for podcasts. So I'd say he sticks around, but I would wonder, because I see this stuff tweeted quite a few times. I don't know the exact details, but they have the union. They got all this stuff. Yeah. And I look at some of these shows. There's probably only, we DM'd about this, probably only maybe today, 3 to 5 shows that probably make money. I mean, the Bill Simmons podcast and the Ryan Russillo one, I kind of just can do the math because I have my own show, is they're quite profitable. I mean, if you have 2 hour long shows with 6 ads in them with decent CPMs that are getting 1 million listens each, and you're doing them as they are at a high rate, I mean, they can be making tens of millions of dollars each year. But some of these other shows I'd be worried about. So it's kind of, I don't know where their studio studios go going forward. I mean, they invested in this giant building in Los Angeles, so I think it'll probably still be there, and I think he probably stays with them. But I think in 2019 they needed them. They needed shows like, you know, The Ringer had. I don't think they need them anymore. And what's going to happen? Are they going to take all their, is the Bill Simmons podcast going to go off of Spotify? Like, they have much better negotiating leverage, I think, with these, any sort of show that's not Joe Rogan.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe the two areas where if he doesn't do Spotify, maybe he would do it. The one thing is I could see him doing his own thing again, right? He starts The Ringer. Obviously, that was a huge success. Right place, right time, but also great execution in terms of building up the company, being audio first. So maybe he could do that, do his own thing. But then kind of to your point, I mean, he has to have a technology partner, ad partner, all that stuff, hire video people. So, you know, I guess JJ Redick does it. So I don't necessarily know what firm or company he's using, but maybe that could be something. And then the other thing, you brought it up, which reminded me of it, and I hadn't been thinking about this, but did you see that Smartless deal with SiriusXM recently? Sirius. That was interesting.
So I did not see the details. I saw the headline. Do you have the?
No, the I don't really have the details of it either. But I obviously saw the headline, so I'm just curious if SiriusXM now increasingly is making a push into podcasts for some reason.
Yeah, they are, but I think from a Spotify perspective, they're small potatoes. I mean, Spotify crushed them in the United States, and if you look internationally, it's kind of similar, I would say, to maybe like a Peacock versus a Netflix, where you're like, well, they can make a decent run and gain some market share in the United States. But then you look at any other country and Netflix just wipes the floor with everyone. I'm trying to bring it up here right now. The user numbers at Pandora, or excuse me, Sirius, who does own Pandora, I think now.
While you're doing that, I got the Smartless one. So Smartless, I'm reading from the press release. New deal includes live events, early access to new episodes, podcasts from the Smartless media slate, and the majority of the Smartless library available exclusively to SiriusXM subs. That's interesting, kind of a historical thing. And then SiriusXM Media also gains exclusive advertising sales, rights to Smartless, and select Smartless media podcasts. So yeah, kind of a similar thing with Spotify, trying to be the advertising infrastructure with these shows.
Yeah. I think it might be too little too late.
I was just thinking that it's too late, yeah.
I got the number. They're at 34 million subs, and it was for the full year 2023. Now, they define it kind of different for all these numbers, but their self-pay subscribers were down 445,000, so they're a pretty leaky boat. Okay, look, like, you can do an exclusive deal, and now I guess that deal is a bit unique, or it's a little bit different, but there's a reason no one wants to do an exclusive deal with SiriusXM anymore. You can get 34 million people, or you can put your show on Spotify, 600 million people around the world, and put it on YouTube, what, 3 billion maybe now at this point around the world, and those are the two platforms that are going to matter. Apple is going to stick around. I don't know how much market share they'll have in 5 years. I would guess because of just lethargy, people are going to stick with Apple Podcasts because they stick with them, but I don't really see them growing because they don't do anything with it. It's just kind of dead. I don't know if you are a user of that, but it doesn't change and it's pretty lame. As a host, I get very frustrated with them because they don't do anything to help us and they give no analytics. So that's very frustrating with working with advertisers, but that's besides the point. I just don't see why. You know, let's say Bill Simmons announced he was going to SiriusXM. Well, he just announced that he's going to be much smaller, like 10% of the size of Spotify. And Spotify is probably going to hit 1 billion users. And the thing with their sports thing stuff is to really make sports podcasts go global. And I think that's the same thing with Rogan, where they said that in like 50 different markets, he became much, much bigger, and his overall listenership actually grew because they were able to get people in India to listen and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And Simmons specifically, there's articles that Spotify wanted to put the BS Pod behind exclusivity with Spotify, and he fought tooth and nail not to have that happen. So, yeah, 100%. I could not see an exclusive deal because he'd not want that. I guess if the money was there, potentially, but yeah, ultimately, I don't see him doing.
Yeah, hey, Amazon does some of these deals that make absolutely no sense, but they got the money to do it. So some of these, I think they bought Wondery and they had someone else that was exclusive, but they basically bought Wondery, and that's like, okay, well, Wondery is not going to be relevant anymore because Amazon touts a lot of numbers about subscribers, but it's just the ones that are merged in with Amazon Prime in general. There's not a soul listening to stuff on Amazon Music. I mean, just look at the people in your life, any listener. Like, their market share is tiny.
No, I don't know. I don't know anybody who uses that. Okay, so I'll read some stats in the press release to set up the from the earnings to set up this next question. So the question is, what does success in podcasting look like? And the stats I'll read off is that last quarter, the premium gross margin, so what we talked about in the first half of the pod, 29.1%, the ad-supported gross margin, 11.6%. So would it be fair to say success looks like getting ad-supported closer to the premium gross margin?
Yes, and I would actually say, given their prior guidance on the unit economics, it should be higher because
Interesting.
they said that over the long term, they want advertising to be 20% of overall revenue, which, if you kind of do the numbers versus how fast premium is growing and can grow, that's a big, big step up. And with maybe 40 to 50% gross margins today, as you mentioned, 11%. Now, I think this year they have a pretty clear path to keep making progress there because they got rid of the deals that were honestly, terrible. The Kim Kardashian deal where, did no episodes, or the Meghan Markle one where you do no episodes and pay them a lot of money. Those ones are gone. Luckily, now you kind of have some of the shows that are in their content budget that are more just existing popular shows that might not get absurd ROIs. But the key is scaling the advertising business. So what's interesting is that if they can get the advertising business to, triple, four times the level of today, the margins are going to be much, much higher. So the ink, like there's actually, as we talked about, there's not very much operating leverage in the music side of business. There should be a lot in the podcasting side of things. So if you kind of think about the advertising network, since it's all self-serve, similar to a YouTube, similar to a Google, similar to a Facebook, the podcasts are doing all the work. And the advertiser makes the advertisement. They're just connecting, and targeting the stuff. So the incremental spend there is going to have extremely high margins. But today you have the content costs, with their studios, like The Ringer. You got the content costs for the licensed shows, which are quite high. And then you also have all the technology in the background for Anchor, Megaphone, all the targeting tools they're trying to build up for the digital advertising network. And they're trying to expand the advertising network to more and more geographies. So when they just launched, it was originally just in English speaking markets, I believe, or might have just been the United States. But if you look at any of your, I'm sure you've looked at it from at least once with the geographical reach of podcast, it's
Sure.
global. Like, I think only half of our listeners are from the United States. So they got nothing, they have to expand this to all the markets that they're in. That's going to take a lot of investment. And the key is they got to grow revenue and advertising to make this thing work. And they're making progress, but they got a long way to go.
Yeah, so speaking of Harry and Meghan, I did an episode that was just a quick reaction to that story when Bill Simmons called them grifters, fucking grifters. And
He's right. I think he's right.
I got a bunch of the UK, Canada, and Australia just shot up the global audience ranks. It was funny because a lot of the podcast surfaced over there, and a lot of people listen to it. But yeah, I mean, the countries, there's even non-English speaking countries that get represented, which is
Yeah.
funny there.
Well, let me give one more anecdote for the listeners to maybe, because I know it's hard. It's kind of easier for us because we use the tool, but when we go to publish a show, say for our show, Chit Chat Stocks, we go to an episode, we do some more organic ads, and they can make more money because you don't have to share the revenue with Spotify. But we have some of those, but when we don't have enough, you know, of the organic ads to fill every spot, we use the Spotify audience network, which is what they call the dynamic ads, and we put in the slots. And if they filled every ad slot we had, it would probably be 5 to 6 times the ad impressions higher than they actually are. So what I mean by that is all the slots that we have for the automated ads are only getting filled 10, 20% of the time. And it still makes a, you know, decent amount of money for whatever on a per ad basis. But in order for them, I think that just shows that they're not getting enough advertising demand to the platform yet, because they would fill all these ads if they could get them there. I mean, what happens every time you open a YouTube video and you don't have premium? You see an ad, but 10 years ago, you might not see any. Do you kind of get how I'm trying to explain that? Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And part of their strategy is to keep on building the ad network. Well, it's kind of, I mean, I think it's maybe similar to what Netflix is doing these days, where they clearly there is a ton of watching going on Netflix, but because I think it's because people just love their product, they don't want to downgrade from the no ads to ad tier. So, you know, we can get to this maybe in a second, but part of the reason they do the WWE deal is to get a much higher number of people on the ad tier deal, because like you've been talking about, you get a bigger ad network, you get bigger sales, and then it's operating leverage, and you're a bigger player in ads. So I think that makes total sense to me.
Well, yeah, and they're a long ways up, but the golden goose for Spotify is to have a scaled advertising network that can not only geographically target people, but target people based on their interests, similar to, you know, Meta. I mean, Meta is the cream of the crop there. They're so much better than everyone at all this stuff, and I guess Google too. But the value you could have for a business to be able to locally target, you know, let's say you're, I don't know, a smaller business, like we were talking earlier how they have the big brands on the Bill Simmons show, like Airbnb and Hilton and stuff like that, which I like how you guys do the jokes about how they're advertising the two competitors and complaining about each other in the ads, which I guess, you know, hey, that kind of shows that they're dynamic insertions because they don't know when they're showing up. But if you can get the smaller companies to advertise as you do on a Meta, which I mean, you know, an Instagram or a Facebook, you can provide way more value than the local advertiser that goes on the local sports show in your city. Because you can target people based on their interest, and they already have so much data around that, they should be, you know, able to do that. It's a long ways off, but that's why they're investing so much into this, is because there's a potential to be a advertising business that's over $10 billion a year with high targeting tools that can have, you know, really, really strong unit economics.
I love that. Is that a good place to stop the Spotify discussion, or do you think anything else we need to touch on?
I think that's good. Yeah, we mentioned, I don't know if you want to talk valuation, but I know we're going a little bit long. Stock's expensive right now, but
yeah, you know what? Kind of like what we talked about before, we probably don't need to, just because I think given the business overview is good enough. So yeah, I mean, look, there's various ways of valuation out there. So this podcast is not a buy or sell Spotify podcast. If you're interested, do your own due diligence on it. I don't know. Yeah,
I should say I don't own it right now. So I'm saying all this optimistic stuff, and I don't own. So I'm not going to profit if it goes up. So yeah.
Why don't we do this? Why don't you introduce your show? Give some background on it. Give some highlights of what you guys do, and then maybe after that we'll finish up. Do a brief discussion of this new sports streaming service and what that means.
Sure. Yeah. So it's called Chit Chat Stocks. You can find it, Spotify, Apple, YouTube, all the other players. And we focus on doing analysis on either individual stocks. So for example, we could do something on Spotify, or we focus on doing analysis on maybe sectors or all sort of stuff. But the key is focusing on, you know, business analysis. We're not doing, as someone, you know, that might be into investing, we don't do any like technical analysis. We're not doing any macroeconomic stuff. We're really focusing on core business analysis. And I guess, for example, we interviewed two really sharp analysts 2 weeks ago. Well, I guess, I don't know when people are listening to this, but it was right after the Netflix earnings. We talked about Netflix for over an hour, talked about the WWE deal, the advertising deal, and kind of the financial implications of all this. So we really want to provide a lot of high quality research, I would say, in audio form. And then we also do some fun kind of live stream type shows with me and Ryan, the other guy that does the podcast. And those are more fun, where we have, I don't know, we have listeners, we have a couple of people that join regularly, ask us questions, and that one can be more about funnier, kind of absurd things you see in the investing world or the business world, which is maybe surprisingly more than you think. But yeah, that's what we do. You know, we always hope to provide a lot of high quality analysis. And yeah, if you're interested in any of that stuff, I think for any of these listeners, the Netflix show, which you'll be able to see in probably the latest 10 episodes or so, that's a really great place to start. And that's kind of a good example of what we try to do.
Yeah, the Netflix show, that's the one January 31st.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, so it's Netflix stock at the end of the streaming wars, which, yeah, I mean, look, for listeners out there, you guys like and listen to my Netflix content. If you guys liked the show, which I'm hoping you did, I think that's this is a great podcast for you to check out. I think people will really, really like this. And then I did happen to notice, so I saw you got a Bill Simmons-esque title in here, which I love. CEO Mount Rushmore debating the widest moats. Are we in 1995 or 1995? Was an episode from January 7th, so that was great.
Yeah, the title's important. You know, we gotta you gotta try to convince everything in there. But yeah, I guess that is similar to the Bill Simmons ones. Which, you know, what's funny is one of my friends, he is a regular Bill Simmons listeners, and he'll text me on Sundays the prediction of the title.
Oh, nice!
And he actually gets it pretty good for the, you know, the Sunday NFL ones. I don't know. He always like surprisingly gets it pretty close. But yeah, that's besides the point.
Nice. And yeah, so for other some other shows, listeners, you got the future of Spotify from December 2023. We got Ferrari. I also liked so you guys, what you read the book on Ray Dalio's hedge fund, the biggest hedge fund in the world. Have you thought about that?
Yeah. So we are, you know, we try to mix things up. And I think over this year and the next few years, we're going to do more, I would say, looking at maybe famous investors and stuff like that. And the Ray Dalio one from the book they had was a little bit, that book was very negative on him. And I kind of agreed with a lot of what they said. So that one might be more negative, but most of the time we're going to look at kind of, you know, successful investors and how they did stuff like that. And I would say another, you know, in December of 2023, we did a kind of luxury stocks theme. So we covered Ferrari, as you mentioned, Hermes, LVMH, which is the Louis Vuitton conglomerate. And then we also had this great discussion with another one where we brought in two analysts discussing the luxury market overview, and people seem to enjoy that. So that's, I'd say, another place to start. That's kind of actually, speaking of tools that Spotify offers, they offer the start, like best place to start now to try to get the discovery up with podcasts. And that's when I recommend to people. So yeah, a lot of stuff out there. Kind of whatever businesses you're interested in, we cover them.
Love it. Well, for everybody listening, I will include the link to that podcast in the podcast description. So obviously, if you liked this discussion, definitely check out that show. All right. So yeah, let's wrap it up here, doing a little current events in the world of sports and streaming. So I think the big one, we have this new potential streaming service, Fox, coming together with Disney and with Warner Brothers Discovery, and essentially getting not all sports, but a pretty decent chunk of sports. I think the big two that were left out were CBS and NBC. Although, of course, with those, if you want to have that, if you want to get those, you can get Peacock and Paramount Plus, and you're able to get the NFL and college football on their services. So What do you think of the idea of that? And what do you think the uptake might be if they actually do get this thing rocking and rolling by the fall?
Yeah, so I'm curious your takes here too, because this is not anything I'm an expert in, as we were talking about before, but my first reaction was this is a sign of desperation from the content providers because they're seeing an acceleration in the decline of the traditional cable bundle subscribers, and that was their cash cow. Still is their cash cow, and their margins are going down a lot. And we mentioned the fixed cost operating leverage with Netflix is kind of going the opposite direction with these guys in the legacy business, is you have these fixed costs, especially when you're into sports, because what is the NFL deal? $11 billion a year spread out across everyone. I think that's the number. You have these fixed costs, you have the studios, you have all that, whatever, the personalities. So you need to have some sort of economies of scale. And in the next few years, if nothing changes with the cable one, I mean, the legacy businesses are going to turn extremely negative, and they have to do something. I think the other reaction I had is I don't know how many people are going to take this up if it's $50, like the rumor is, because how much cheaper is that than YouTube TV? $25? I mean, what's the incremental buyer there from a sports fan? Maybe I would do it. I don't know, but I just wonder how many, it's not that cheaper than the cable bundle. And in order to replace all that revenue, you need to make it quite expensive, which is why they're pricing it very high, or twice as, three times as much as a Netflix subscription. I just don't know. I just think there's four companies out there that can outbid them, and it doesn't matter. There's Amazon, Apple, YouTube, and Netflix, I guess, to an extent now. I worry about what is it, five of them, the traditional players in sports, Disney through ESPN, Fox, Warner Brothers, which is like TNT, TBS for anyone that doesn't know, and then what, the Paramount with CBS, and then NBC, which is Comcast. I just, what does this look like in 3 years? I don't know. And are they going to get 10 million people to sign up for this thing? I highly doubt it, especially because, I mean, the tech is certifiably going to be terrible. I would guess. I mean, Netflix can barely get these live streams working. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you from all right, so let's say so I've heard between 40 to 50 various reports have that. So let's go between it. Let's say it's $45. So YouTube TV 70, $75. So that basically means that are there people willing to not pay the YouTube TV of $70 a month but want this product for 45?
Exactly.
Maybe there are, but to be, but what YouTube TV also includes is CBS and NBC, which this product doesn't. So ultimately, as a sports fan, if you want to get basically all sports, you're buying this for $45 a month, and then you're paying another probably $15 for Paramount Plus and Peacock, which
Right.
means you're already at 60. So, okay, maybe there's a $10 savings, but then from the other perspective, I go, okay, let's think about, and Bill Simmons talked about this in his podcast, being like, I don't know how the hell my dad is gonna get this Peacock game, right?
Yeah.
There's a huge outcry about that. So, do we think that the average bundle user, which I think has a pretty high median age, I mean, if you
Oh,
look at
yeah.
what the ratings are for these typical TV channels, it's 50, 60. I think cable news might be in the 65s is like the average age range watching the news stations. So if you think about it from that perspective, are you really going to get people who have had a cable TV bundle for decades to save $20 to downgrade to this? I'm a little skeptical of that. Where I am a little bit more intrigued is I would call it maybe a lot of people listening to this show, and actually if when I post this on Twitter, if you guys have a comment on this, definitely let me know. Where I think it might be somewhat interesting is like NBA, for example. I feel like more people would watch the NBA if they didn't have to pay the $75 a month for the YouTube TV. So I think a lot of the younger NBA fan base, I don't know how open they are to $45 a month, but maybe there are some that are open to that and that would subscribe to this and not the YouTube TV. And so I think that's where, and if you listen to Bob Iger in the Disney earnings call, if you listen to Lachlan Murdoch, who's the CEO of Fox, on their call, obviously they're talking their book, meaning that they're going to advocate for their position. But what they're saying is that they ultimately think this is going to be additive because you're going to get people who don't want to pay the 75, but would pay the 40, 45. That's the best case scenario. Will it be that? Will it not be that? I don't know. But I think there is a demo for it, but I agree with you from like, is this going to, you know, immediately get to 10 million subs overnight? I think absolutely not. This is going to be a slow process. You might have an initial surge of a million or something, but I think it's going to be slow moving until people wrap their head around, if I get this product, but I want the NFL, I also have to get and learn how to work and whatnot, Peacock and Paramount Plus, because without those, that it's just a tough non-starter for people.
Yeah, I agree with that. I just struggle to see what their strategy is, because they're going to lose. What are these people paying, say, like $100 a month, say a cable subscriber, a traditional one, that's say $1,000 a year. You have a million of them, you know, for each million they lose, that's $1 billion in revenue. A lot of that is going to the content providers. So can you replace? They're going to lose 10, 20. They've already lost so much, but they're going to lose $10, $20 billion a year. They replace some of it with Disney Plus and ESPN Plus and all these other ones. But can you replace $10 to $20 billion in revenue loss per year when your obligations to these sports leagues are fixed? Like, yeah. Especially the NFL. I really struggle to see how it's going to work. And what maybe the thing I don't understand the most is how the NBA thinks. I guess maybe I don't get it, but I struggle to see how they're going to triple their rights. I don't, unless someone like an Amazon or a YouTube comes over the top and says, we'll do it all for $7 billion, I don't see why one of these companies would take on the NBA for $7 billion a year, because it makes sense for none of these companies. I mean, maybe if they did it 5 years ago and they did this thing with a sports streaming service that had, say, the same thing they had here, I really wish they could have all sports for one little bundle. You know, you have the local sports, all that stuff, but I guess it's not feasible given all the contracts. But say they did this 5 years ago, they made it at a more aggressive price point, like cheaper. And then you really work on the advertising technology, because as we've seen with the Hulu ad-supported tier, the Netflix ad-supported tiers, you can get a significant lift in your revenue per month on these advertisements in sports. You know, it's built on advertising. I would much rather see them go for $20, $25 and then hopefully over time, you know, get a nice little boost up to that $50, $60 with all the advertising. Maybe it works that way, but yeah, I don't want to touch any of this stuff. I think when we had that pod on Netflix, those two guys that we had on, Alex from TSOH Investing Research and Francisco, who runs an investment management company, they follow the media industry for, you know, the last 10 years, and they know these companies inside and out. And you just come away saying, look, Netflix is the only one executing, and the big tech companies, you know, it's a sideshow for them, but they have the firepower. I mean, Apple's done quite well with their stuff. I'm sure it doesn't make any money, but they could triple their spend if they really wanted to. Amazon, if you listen to their call and if you listen to YouTube, or, you know, it's on the Alphabet call, they keep talking about how this is just the first stage in their sports content investments. If I'm one of these traditional legacy players, what can you do? I mean, you've already lost. You're 10 years, 15 years behind. And people can say, yeah, well, Disney launched with their subscription services, but ESPN Plus is not going to move the needle. And I think that was just a flawed strategy from the start. I mean, we're on the R. Bill Simmons podcast. He was right saying that they needed to go quicker and that it eventually was going to catch up to him. And, you know, you talk about how he's lost his fastball, and I kind of agree with you. I do not listen nearly as much anymore, but his takes on the future of media then are always spot on.
Yeah, so on the NBA point, and then I think let's finish up Netflix WWE deal and what that means. So on the NBA point, yeah, I think the 3X is pie in the sky. That's aggressive. That's not happening with any other big media deal out there. So that just doesn't seem like it's going to happen. I do think they might be able to get a 2X, but it would require ESPN, ABC, and Warner Brothers Discovery keeping rights, and then also expanding and giving it to both NBC and Amazon. So I think if you expand it from 2 to 4, and then you basically get ABC and Warner Brothers Discovery to pay a similar amount, and then you bring on these two new ones, they can basically double it. That can work. Maybe that's even too positive. I don't know. But yeah, I think where we're at in the sports rights landscape is a very interesting one, because linear TV, cable TV, the bundle, that's clearly in decline. And so it's going to be much harder for them to pay certainly as high increases as they have previously, but maybe even increases in general. And then, but then you compare that to right now, yes, it's stopped a little bit on streaming, but we are still in the streaming land grab era. I mean, we're late innings in the land grab, but we're still in it. So I think like an Amazon, like you said, early innings, I think Amazon still can kind of theoretically overpay a little bit to get some sports. Peacock, right, they're doing $110 million for one NFL playoff game. Would Peacock want to get in on the NBA? I think sure. So I think right now, streamers are okay paying a little bit more than they should just to get more subs. But yeah, I think kind of fast forward to 2030, the linear ecosystem is really not going to have that much money to play with. And the question by that point is has streaming grown enough to offset the losses that the linear TV is not going to be able to pay? And I think that's the big question. Maybe not. And so maybe transitioning to Netflix, a huge seismic shift is Netflix for years and years not saying they'd be into live sports. And yes, you can quibble with wrestling as live sports or not, but for the purposes of the conversation, Netflix is getting into live, which is important. WWE is live. And that is taking content that was always on the cable TV bundle and putting it on Netflix. So yeah, I think the title of your pod was that Netflix won the streaming wars. I think I had the same exact tweets that I said Netflix officially won. When they got the WWE and they start peeling off content, sports content from the cable TV bundle, they have won. They're dominating. They have the most money to spend. They're now going to get into even new subscribers, because you're going to get people that are huge WWE fans going to Netflix. And why was the TKO stock, which is the combination of UFC and WWE, why was that stock up so much, even though it wasn't necessarily a great it was a long financial deal, but if you compare the metrics, it wasn't necessarily a massive increase. But why was TKO up? It was because investors loved the idea that they were on Netflix and they were going to get exposure to all their subs. So yeah, so I'm curious your perspective, but my thought was that yeah, this basically crowned Netflix as they officially won. Yes, they have to do things to maintain that, but the way they're going now, they're on an excellent glide path for the future and in a much better position than the other streamers.
Yeah, and HBO just started relicensing stuff. I mean, I'll get to the sports one just as another side note. How insulting is it to all these other companies that the most streamed show on Netflix this year was Suits? And think about that. Like, I mean, how, like, they just say, look, we're just better at getting this in front of people. I mean, the consumption hours are the only one that rivals them is YouTube. But on a sports perspective, Netflix, they've shown they're smarter than everyone. They run circles around everyone. They basically convinced every other streamer to not put on advertisements except for a few, a select few, because they said, hey, look, we don't think streaming needs advertising. And I think that was just kind of a little head fake and saying like, oh yeah, yeah, you guys start these really bad streaming businesses with no advertising and see how it works for you. And then we'll start, oh wait, we changed our mind. We're going to do advertising now. Actually, we were wrong, you know, but they with sports are again smart because they're going after smaller players. They have a big relationship with Formula One. They have a growing relationship with golf and tennis. And now WWE, and it's more stuff that isn't the traditional sports, but sports entertainment, because on top of this, they have the reality TV type stuff to go along with all these, with WWE. Now they don't have the rights to Formula One or golf or tennis, but I would assume those are kind of the next maybe steps they would take just because they have those prior relationships. But you can have the reality TV shows, you know, the documentary type styles. I mean, Apple is doing a very similar thing. I mean, whoever runs Apple TV is extremely smart, because I don't know how they just put out all the best stuff. And they came to the same conclusion, I think, as Netflix, where they did the MLS deal. Yeah, they got lucky because Messi showed up, and now they have all this, you know, these like two separate documentaries with Messi that are going to do quite well. But with Netflix, WWE, yeah, they're not going to go after NFL, NBA, at least at this moment. You know, they're not going to go after the MLB. They're not going to go after hockey. They're going to go after these smaller places that have these niche fan bases that are convince all of the diehard fans, or I don't know how many there are in wrestling, maybe a couple million diehards. They're going to convince them to go there, but they can do all this stuff on top of it to convince more fans to watch from around the globe, WWE, grow the WWE fan base, and make money at the same time. I think it's very similar to the Formula One deal, except even more, because now, you know, with Formula One, they didn't host the events.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's an incredible strategy. And I think, I mean, I just
and it
saw
connects to, one thing, it connects to the advertising, because advertising, like having no advertising division, but then getting into sports wouldn't make any sense. But now that they have the advertising tech, it makes sense to get into sports and more live stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I mean, to look at the landscape, Netflix for the longest time, yeah, they said no advertising. But ultimately, as we were talking about half an hour ago, yeah, they faced some competition for a bit there. I mean, they're all of a sudden it was, you know, went from Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon to everybody and their brother had a streamer. I mean, it was incredible. So they hit some subscriber losses. They said, you know what, we got to have a lower dollar tier to get people up. I think that's going to be very important internationally as well. When, you know, like India, we talked about for Spotify, India, they've had trouble there, but they're not the only ones. Amazon has, Disney has. So it makes sense to build up the ad tech for international. But man, you get live content like WWE for that ad tier. That is just massive. So yeah, immediately once I saw that news, I said that's just a huge get for Netflix. That they're not only going to be doing WWE here, but internationally. And that's why I do think they're a dark horse of some kind for some NBA. If you were to ask me right now, are they going to win any NBA? I would say no. But they're out there, you know, who the hell knows? Maybe they could only do the midseason tournament or something, but they're doing all the what I forget the term that Ted, the CEO, uses, but it's like bumper content or shoulder programming.
Sports entertainment or no? Or is that
different? I think he calls it shoulder programming, but basically it's the documentaries following the teams. And then, as everybody knows in the pod, like I'm a big Red Sox fan. And Bill Simmons should love this as the Boston sports guy. Netflix is going to be following the Red Sox in 2025 for a documentary series. So, yeah, all of a sudden, boom, you know, yes, the younger fans like Netflix, they're going to be on there. But get your boomer parents that are huge baseball fans onto Netflix to watch a documentary on their favorite team throughout the season. I mean, I think it's such a good strategy.
Yeah, I think. And maybe this is too much speculation because I'm not in these meetings, but I believe the tech companies are letting the sports leagues bankrupt the legacy players, and then they're going to come in and eventually get it, which I mean, from a sports right perspective, is they're not going to touch the NFL or NBA because this NFL deal could, or wait, did I say the NFL? I hope it, yeah, I think I missaid something, but the NFL deal is $11 billion a year, as we talked about. This could bankrupt some of the people that paid for this. I mean, Fox stuck with this. Some of these traditional companies, I mean, even ESPN, I think they're going to wait it out because why get into these ugly sports rights deals where the leagues have all the power when you can still make money and reinvest with, as you said, the shoulder programming that people love.
Yeah. And ultimately, the NFL is locked for so long anyway, and that's the number one product. So, yeah, so Amazon got in, probably overpaid, but whatever. Amazon got in, and then, yeah, we'll see what they do for the NBA. I'll be keeping close eye on that for this pod. But, man, this was fantastic. Do we need to cover anything else? I want to be respectful of your time, but, I mean, I think we covered a ton here.
I think that's it. Yeah, we went for a long time, but I think it was good stuff. I hope the listeners enjoyed it. I would just say, if you want more stock analysis, go listen to Chit Chat Stocks, and you can listen to us, me and Ryan, the other co-host, ramble about stocks every week.
Love it. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, certainly. Anybody who has made it this far in the show, if you've enjoyed this one, 100%, go check that out. You've got a Twitter feed for that, as well as your own Twitter account. So I'll put both those in the episode description as well, in addition to the Spotify link. But man, Brett, big thank you again. Really gracious with your time here. And I think I got a lot out of this. I learned a lot about Spotify. I think the listeners who, you know, if it's any indication from the discussion that's in the Bill Simmons subreddit, I mean, I posted the article about Rogan re-upping at Spotify, and man, that was the top post of the day, 200 plus comments. So people absolutely love that stuff, and so I think this conversation, I think people will really get a lot of good information out of.
I hope they do, and thank you for having me.
Awesome, man. Cheers. Have a good night, and we'll talk to the listeners later.